Taking Stock.
Brought to you by PwC.
This is News Talk.
So hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton and this is the show that looks at business and economics from a wider perspective. So coming up on today's show, has the UK essentially voted against Brexit following this week's deal with the EU? And housing is the biggest crisis facing Ireland, but how are things in other countries? And is a housing shortage a global issue? So we're going to talk to two mortgage broking experts from the UK and New Zealand. Plus...
I don't tip.
You don't believe in tipping? Let me just get this straight. You don't ever tip, huh?
I don't tip because society says I have to. All right, I mean, I'll tip if somebody really deserves a tip. If they really put forth the effort, I'll give them something extra. But I mean, it's tipping automatically. It's for the birds.
We look at the thorny issue of tipping and ask, do Irish people give enough in gratuities? Now, on a personal note this week, I want to give a personal shout out to my colleagues here in News Talk on the fantastic achievement of growing their respective shows. The JNLR figures last week really showed how they're bringing conversations that count to you right around the country and far beyond. And a special word of congratulations to John Fardy, the producer of this show, whose audience at screen time grew over 28%. Now, you can email the show, takingstock@newstalk.com, or you can message me on LinkedIn, X, Instagram and Blue Sky at Susan Hayes-Cullerton. And we really do love to hear from you. And I'm going to share some messages that you've been sending in to us over the past couple of days with you a little bit later on in the show. But first, I want to start off by explaining to you the difference between fiscal and monetary policy, as they're both in the news a lot. So fiscal policy, it's all about taxes and spending. So you've likely heard this week all about President Trump talking about his big, beautiful tax bill and what that means for spending. So that's the type of thing that falls in under fiscal policy. And in Ireland, we've control over our taxes and spending. But on the other hand, monetary policy then refers to interest rates, exchange rates and money supply. And since we joined the euro, the ECB or the European Central Bank has control over that. So when you hear about the ECB cutting interest rates, and that affects, of course, how much you pay back in your mortgage or how much you get when you save, that's an example of monetary policy at play. So in summary, fiscal is taxes and spending, and monetary is interest rates, exchange rates and money supply. Now, it was either the Great Reset, which was much needed, or else an utter capitulation that sold out the Brexit dream. Yes, this week we saw the UK and the EU signing an accord which both parties hope will reset the relationship, which is fractured by both the Brexit referendum and the painful breakup negotiations led by Boris Johnson. So, but will it work? So I'm delighted to be joined by George Parker, the political editor of the Financial Times. George, you're very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, first off, 46% of British trade is done with the EU. And Keir Starmer said that this reset deal would boost the economy by £9 billion per year by 2040. Can you walk us through what the deal will cover?
Well, yes. I mean, that's £9 billion might sound like a lot of money, but actually it's a drop in the ocean compared with the amount of trade we've lost because of Brexit in the last few years. But nevertheless, it's, I think, seen as a useful first step. So the biggest prize, I suppose, out there was this idea of a security and defence pact. That was the one thing that was concretely signed between Britain and the UK, sort of in response to the need for the continent to rearm and to work more closely together. And then on the economic side, there were a whole load of measures which sort of crept us back closer, I suppose, to the European single market, while obviously not being part of it or indeed the customs union. So there was an agreement that would make it easier for British food producers to send their products into the European Union market and vice versa, a so-called veterinary agreement, which removes some of the hurdles and barriers to trade. And there was, in exchange, a deal around youth mobility. A lot of details to be fleshed out there, but the idea is that this would allow more EU students to come and young people generally to come and live and work in the United Kingdom, learn English and go to British universities. And then crucially, and there's never a European negotiation which doesn't involve fish. There was a deal which saw, for another 12 years, European Union fishermen being able to operate in UK waters as they currently do, something which has caused a lot of problems for Keir Starmer back at home.
Now, I want to delve into all of them, but I want to start with the veterinary agreement, because that seems to be the biggest outcome here. And that, just for to bring listeners up to date on this, it was referring to the vast majority of agri-food exports to the EU would happen then without checks and certificates. And of course, we have to talk about the term dynamic alignment of standards. Do you think this is the biggest outcome? And what does this mean, particularly for people who are in the agri-food sector?
I think it probably is. In terms of the economic side of things, it's certainly the most important thing. one of the biggest sectors affected by Brexit and the increased barriers to trade were trade in foodstuffs, animals, plants, shellfish in particular, because of the sort of sheer multitude of forms you have to fill in and so forth. And British government even built a huge new lorry park near Dover where they were going to carry out all these checks, which is now incidentally on the market for sale because they won't need it anymore with a bit of luck. So it is useful, I think, to standardise the food standards and animal welfare standards between the two sides. But this is crucial. I think this is why it's really important. It's, as you say, it's this thing called dynamic alignment, which is jargon for the fact that Britain will basically align with rules made in Brussels in the foodstuffs area. But not just that, it will have to apply new rules that are made by the EU in future. This is the dynamic alignment bit, which, if you put it in crude terms, means that rules that are made in Brussels will be sent over by email to be copy and pasted into the British law book legislative framework by British parliamentarians. It's the thing that Brexiteers wanted to avoid at all costs. You know, this is the surrender of sovereignty. And, you know, it's a big step. It's a crossing of the Rubicon, I think, for a British government. And once you accept the idea that you're going to take Brussels rules in the interests of freer trade, and you're prepared to accept a role for the European Court of Justice, and you're prepared to pay some money to Brussels for the benefit of doing this, then you open up a whole load of other things in future, I think.
You do, George, right? But on the other hand, for the past 9 years, really the UK hasn't diverged much from the EU rules anyway when it had the choice.
Of course not, because we're not some rogue state operating off the coast of Europe. We all want the same thing, which is to protect consumers from dodgy foodstuffs. So why would we? You know, it's a ridiculous thing. It was always a ridiculous idea that we would want to diverge from European Union standards. We're all in the same boat together. There have been some examples, though, I should say, where Britain thinks it has been able to exploit being outside the European Union, for example, in the development of new types of crop, gene-edited crops, different to genetically modified crops, which the EU is still very reluctant to move on. So I think there is some concern we might lose some of that sort of advantage in developing new kinds of pioneering crops. But generally, of course, we want the same thing.
Well, now, you did mention about being in the same boat, and could we get onto that for a moment here? Because in terms of fishing, this seems to be hugely politically contentious, and I'd like to explore this a little bit with you. The deal cements the existing agreement. Basically, that's what it does, admittedly for 12 years, but it simply cements the existing agreement, which has seen the EU catches in UK waters drop by a quarter in 5 years. George, what's the problem?
It's a really good question. I mean, basically, as you say, cements the current agreement. What it does, it gets away from the idea of having annual negotiations. So the existing deal, which was a transition deal after Brexit, was due to be renewed in 2026. And after that, there would be an annual haggle over fish between Britain and the European Union, which obviously would have created a lot of uncertainty. So Keir Starmer's trying to present this as best he can as a good deal for British fishermen, that it gives them certainty. He's bung them 350 million quid to help coastal communities. So yet more money for an industry which, has to be pointed out, accounts for only 0.03% of the British economy. But there's another big prize, I think, out of all this for the British fishing industry, which is that 70% of the fish we catch in Britain, or British waters, or UK trawlermen catch, goes off to markets in particularly France and Spain, for the reason that we don't actually eat a lot of the fish that we catch, you know, sort of shellfish, monkfish, hake and things like that. They aren't on the British menu, so they're sent over to the continent. And so having smoother food safety rules and easier trade on those things will actually help fishermen as well, in particular fishermen.
Well, if we compare what you just said there, the 0.03% of economic output, to UK food and drink exports to the UK were £14 billion in 2024. And these exports to the EU, naturally enough, as would have expected, fell by more than a third since 2019. So how is it, George, from a political perspective, that the voice of food and drink exporters doesn't seem to be as loud as that of the fishermen?
It's really interesting, isn't it, that you, I mean, if you think back to the Brexit debates and the famous battle on the River Thames where Nigel Farage sailed up the River Thames on a fishing boat and stuff, it's just one of those things that's sort of emotive. Boris Johnson spent a disproportionate amount of time at fishing ports. But a lot of fishermen feel betrayed by Brexit for the reasons I was just describing there, because they weren't able to sell any longer the fish they caught. They were sort of ending up rotting in customs warehouses in Dover rather than being on the fish market in Boulogne. So you're right, there's kind of an emotive issue around the fishing community. However, You've also seen big food retailers like Marks and Spencers, for example, saying this is great news for British consumers. It will have easier trade with the EU, and that will mean lower prices on the supermarket shelves. And this is, I think, where Kemi Badenoch, the Conservative leader's running into trouble, or could potentially run into trouble, because she's condemned the deal. She says she wants to reverse some of this surrender of sovereignty as she sees it. Well, how do you explain that in the next election campaign when she has to try and, you know, take on Marks and Spencers and other big food retailers and say she's going to put food prices back up in the shops? I think it's going to be a very hard sell.
Well, George, certainly the UK population needs lower prices given the inflation figures that came out this week. But another thing that, as I was watching this unfold with Prime Minister's questions during the week in the House of Commons, I was struck by the conversation around the youth mobility scheme. Because you would swear that the UK doesn't do youth mobility with anybody else. But when I looked into it, you have a youth mobility scheme in Australia, Canada, New Zealand, South Korea, Andorra, Iceland, San Marino, Monaco, Uruguay, Hong Kong, Taiwan, and even kind of with India as well. So this isn't necessarily freedom of movement of people, as Keir Starmer says, because it's capped and time limited. So is this youth mobility scheme fundamentally going to be a positive for young Britons?
Of course it is. It's going to make life easier for young Britons going across to the European Union and for EU students and young people coming over to the UK. I mean, it's a great thing, but it's not free movement. You know, there's some sort of frankly misleading rhetoric around this being used by the Conservatives and others who say this will be free movement for young people. And of course, free movement, they're trying to associate in people's minds the idea of large numbers of people coming over and adding to the net migration issue in the UK. The fact is that these numbers will be capped, as they are with all those other schemes you just mentioned. You'll have to get a visa to come over here, so that's not the same as free movement. And you'll only be able to stay for a certain amount of time. Again, that's different to free movement. So it's not free movement, and it will be beneficial to young people on both sides of the channel. So, you know, most people, I think, will see this as a good thing. And I think there's a lot of disquiet, I would say, among some moderate Conservative voters that we're hearing some of the rhetoric of the Brexit years, surrender, betrayal, and all the rest of it, when people would rather just move on.
And there is a lot of emotions around that, like to hear terms like surrender or giving up sovereignty. It doesn't sound like any of that really is happening, is it?
I think the criticism of the deal, if there, and there has been criticism of the deal, is not so much that this is a huge act of betrayal, but it's a lack of ambition on the part of Keir Starmer's government. This is, you know, quite small beer. You know, 0.2% extra GDP in 2040, that compares with 4% of lost GDP as a result of Brexit. So only making up a tiny fraction of the amount of lost wealth we've given away because of Brexit. So I think the criticism is too modest. However, I think it's important to be seen as a sort of, you know, step in the right direction, confidence building between the two sides. The idea that you can have a serious negotiation between Britain and the EU doesn't descend into acrimony. People can get an agreement. And who knows, you know, does the fact, as I mentioned earlier, the fact that we've now accepted that we are prepared to take rules from Brussels and make payments into the EU budget, that does allow you to get closer to the European Union. And then who knows, one day, though I suspect not anytime soon, the debate will start in the UK about whether we might want to re-enter the customs union, and then ultimately, who knows, the single market. And in my children's lifetime, possibly the European Union itself.
Well, I mean, a Davy, leader of the Lib Dems, certainly asked about that. And I know Keir Starmer then said, well, no, we can't be doing that because of the agreement made with the US and India. And of course, they're certainly very newsworthy, and we could talk about those too. But I particularly want to hone in on one area. You mentioned about the small beer related to GDP, and I want to talk about a very big topic. Energy. Because requiring separate power auctions after Brexit has cost the UK around about £400 million. And the consultancy Baringa estimated the total savings for consumers from an integrated market could reach €44 billion a year. Now, on the other hand, Nigel Farage, leader of Reform UK, says that council staff working on climate change initiatives should look for alternative careers. So, George, what is the politics around energy, taking all of that into consideration?
To be honest, I think that the politics around energy are far less complicated than they are around fish or free movement, simply because nobody, I suspect, outside a very small group of experts, understand how the integrated energy market works. It's not an issue of public debate over here. And I think most people would agree the idea of having electricity interconnectors joining Britain up to the EU is not something that involves the transfer of sovereignty. Some of those numbers that you mentioned there, the €44 billion a year, I mean, that sounds absolutely extraordinary, if true. I have my doubts, to be honest.
Mm. Oh, George, it's been fascinating to talk to you, and I could continue this conversation for a lot longer. Thank you indeed for joining us, George Parker, the political editor of the Financial Times.
Pleasure.
This is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we ask if other countries find it so hard to buy a house. So welcome back to Taking Stock on News Talk. I'm Susan Hayes-Cullerton, and I'd like to share some messages that we've received in the past week about the show. I'm going to start off from Sheila Bailey here, who sent in a message about charity shops, and she's based in London. She said some shops specialise in linens, one in particular that had a reputation for great linens for years, and some specialise in designer handbags, but you have to know where to go if you're a savvy shopper, and I'm not giving away any of those secrets, which is a pity for the rest of us. I also want to give a shout out here as well to Monica, who sent in an email into the show to say, great to hear such a dynamic, intelligent and interesting show on the radio today. She said she's tuned in and looking forward to hearing more about stocks. And also to a woman called Cora, who sent us a message on Facebook. She's home from America and said that she's delighted to be able to tune in and listen to the show that's happening right now. So really, really delighted to have you listening to us as well, Cora. Now, earlier this week, Ireland hosted the World Summit of the International Mortgage Brokers Federation, and it focused on who advises who when it comes to housing, how different countries are facing different challenges when it comes to getting home loans, as well as how technology is changing the experience for everybody. So joining me in studio is Lee Hodgetts from Finance and Mortgage Advisors Association of New Zealand. And on the line, we have Stacey Penn, Head of Policy at the Association of Mortgage Intermediaries in the UK, both of whom were at that conference. First of all, hello to you both. You're both very welcome.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for having me.
You're here on Irish time now, Lee. And what I'm going to do is start off, first of all, by asking you what's going on with the mortgage market in the UK and New Zealand. And how are you facing the challenges that we share in terms of how difficult it is simply to get a mortgage and a house? So, Lee, can we go to you first? What's it like on the ground in New Zealand at the moment?
Sure. It's a really tough property market at the moment, particularly for first home buyers. We are experiencing falling interest rates, which is very helpful. So we've got a real shift in the availability and the affordability, I guess, to buy homes at the moment. Prices are really expensive, and particularly in Auckland and Wellington, where it's at least average $1 million to buy a property. So when you're looking at a 20% deposit, that's some really big dollars for people getting into their first home, for example.
And Stacey, can I go to you? What's your take of what it's like on the ground in the UK?
Yeah, so similar to what Lee's saying, we're also experiencing a falling interest rate environment. The Bank of England recently reduced the base rate to 4.25%. There's some commentators that say this could fall to 3.5, 3.75% at the end of the year. But we did just this week have some inflation figures out that might impact that. Inflation rose to higher than was expected, up from 2.6% in March to 3.5%. So much higher than the Bank of England's target of 2%. And again, similar to Lee, we're experiencing similar challenges in the UK around affordability, wages not keeping up with the cost of property, as well as housing supply.
Okay, so both of you are talking about falling interest rates. Both of you are talking about an affordability challenge. Lee, you mentioned there, for example, houses costing more than $1 million. And needing the 20% deposit. And as you also say there, Stacey, like you've got very significant inflation there, which probably will put downward pressure on interest rates. But Lee, one of the discussion points of the conference this week was that in New Zealand, people can borrow from their future selves, basically take money out of their pensions to get on the property ladder or pay down debt. How does this work?
Okay, so it's a really interesting way to put it. We call it KiwiSaver, so that's our superannuation or retirement saving. So it's the money that you're actually contributing yourself, but also your employer would make a contribution. And at the moment, the rate's only 3% that your employer will contribute, and you can match that with 3%. So it's based on your salary. It's not a mandatory thing to do. So it's a choice whether you actually start saving for your retirement. At the moment, we had some news. We had the budget come out in New Zealand yesterday, so it's quite timely to talk about this. They're increasing that contribution rate to up to 4% over the next 2 years. The government also does do a bit of a co-contribution. They just, if you put some money in, they'll actually put a few hundred dollars in a year just to give you a little bit of a buffer. What you're able to do, once you've been in KiwiSaver for at least 3 years, if you're a first home buyer, you can use some of your money or most of that money then to go towards your deposit to buy your first home. So it is tapping into the money that you're really provisioning for future superannuation or future pension to get into the property market now. So it's an interesting concept, but it's very widely used, and it just helps people get on the property ladder, apart from the Bank of Mum and Dad, who we know are one of the biggest banks in the world.
That's and growing so, certainly. And that's a topic that we looked at on the show last week. All right. But before I go to Stacey and I ask if this could be a solution to the affordability gap in the UK, can I ask Lee, when I think about when I started my pension and, you know, you're starting off, you've got relatively little money that you have put in there as a nest egg, etc. Could this really make a difference to people if they're, like, you were talking about this in the context of buying your first home at an early stage? Is there enough in the pension then to make a difference?
No, you'd really be wanting to be in a fund for quite a number of years and also make sure that the investment in that fund isn't too conservative and isn't in too many high risk sort of like a portfolio, because you can actually choose how that fund is invested. The change in the value of your fund will go up and down as the market does, because it's essentially like a managed fund portfolio. So the longer you're in it, obviously the longer, the bigger the balance is, the more growth opportunity that you have in there. So it's often that you're paying into that for quite a number of years before there is enough to actually help towards that deposit. But it is something, and it's better than nothing.
Oh, for sure. And you talk about it being timely because of the budget in New Zealand this week. It's really timely in Ireland because there's a lot of conversation around auto-enrolment, and we're looking at your neighbours particularly for inspiration around that. So, Stacey, could this work in the UK where we see 50% of people getting help from the bank of mum and dad in order to get on the property ladder?
Yeah, so it's really interesting to hear Lee speak about how that actually works in practice in New Zealand. I think here in the UK, I do feel it's a short-term solution which could create a longer-term problem. We know that there's a massive pensions deficit in the UK, lots of people moving from defined benefit pensions to defined contribution pensions, where every penny will count. We know we've got a falling birth rate as well in the UK, and so that puts into question whether the state pension will actually be around, something that I certainly think about for when I reach retirement age. But it is an area that the UK regulator, the FCA, is exploring. The chief exec, Nikhil Ratti, has mentioned it as an area in one of his speeches. But I think what perhaps is needed is innovation, where there could be an opportunity to create a product that operates like an offset mortgage, where that pension is still sits there, but is used as a guarantee. So I think something like that could work, and is certainly something that should be explored.
Stacey, I'd like to explore that idea of the short term versus the long term, because as listeners will probably be aware, one of the key challenges with pensions is people put money in and they don't really think about the risk they're taking, or they don't maybe move into higher risk funds at an earlier stage, or indeed down either. If people are taking money out of their pensions to put money into their homes, that is likely to be an appreciating asset from a values point of view, and actually give them stability of income, or at least decreasing the need to generate extra income later on in their years for their mortgage. So as a result, could it be that this would be the incentive to take more care of what you're putting money into because it's literally closer to home?
Yeah, it could be. I know that just general financial literacy in the UK is quite poor. I know when I first started work and was put in an auto-enrolment pension, I didn't actually realise that a pension was an investment. So I think anything that can help educate people and just make them think a bit more about their future retirement planning is definitely helpful.
Lee, can I pick up on Stacey's point there about financial literacy, right? Because I took a look into this. It's an area that's very close to my heart anyway, but one third, 31%, so close enough to one third, of young adults have turned to online sources such as TikTok, etc., for insight around financial guidance and information. I got that from a research from Santander UK. Is the mortgage and the mortgage broking industry preparing to meet people where they're at on social media?
It's really picked up in New Zealand. We're seeing social media, LinkedIn, Instagram, a whole lot of things actually. A lot of advisors actually giving some great insights and explaining the real basics to consumers, and a lot of it's first home buyers too, because they tend to be drawn to that type of media to get knowledge and to learn. So we are seeing it as a really rising part of educating buyers and consumers in generally in New Zealand.
Well, in case you're just joining us, I am talking to Lee Hodgetts from the Finance and Mortgage Advisors Association of New Zealand and Stacey Penn, Head of Policy at the Association of Mortgage Intermediaries in the UK. And we're having a chat around the mortgage market and the mortgage broking market. And Lee, you just made the point there around where people go to get advice. But Stacey, a staggering figure that you shared at the conference this week is 97% of mortgages are advised in the UK and 85% of mortgages are sourced through a broker, which highlights that people really trust mortgage advisors in the UK. Can you tell us what has led to such high percentages?
So some of it is down to regulation. So after the financial crisis, the FCA came in to put some requirements in place that where there's interactive dialogue between the customer and a firm, then they need to give advice. So that's part of it that has driven that, because back in 2013, I think the figure was more around 50%. So that just shows really how much that has increased. But then also, I think, just linked to your point there, Susan, there is that demand for advice, especially we've been through COVID, the cost of living. People want help. They need that assistance to hold their hand and guide them through that process.
And I think it's since... Stacey, it was one of the biggest decisions that you make that is going to have a consequence, a significant consequence to your personal finances and your personal life for a very, very long time. So I can see the merit of it. It struck me that it was so high in the UK. And Lee, obviously, you were here at the World Summit. People had come from all over the world in order to be here in Dublin for this particular conference. What do you think is working well in Ireland? Because we can often talk about what's not, you know, when it comes to housing, we often can talk about what's not working. And that conversation absolutely is merit. But what do you think is working well, or what did you learn from the summit that you want to bring home to New Zealand with you?
I really found that Ireland and New Zealand are in a very similar place as far as we talk about open banking, technology, AI, all of those sorts of things, innovation that's coming in that will accelerate processes, the speed, the technology, comparison tools, all of these sorts of things that makes the whole home loan process just more robust, and access to information will help buyers. We are looking at open banking should be coming to New Zealand at the end of 2025. So that's where we're at. We're getting ready for it. The government has enforced it and more or less said we are about 10 years behind the rest of the world, and we need to get cracking with this, because it's going to make a real difference and to lenders. We've got new lenders coming into our country. We've got more opportunities to do so. So I'm finding that New Zealand and Ireland are in a very similar situation there. So we have got some work to do. But the percentage of people that are actually going to see mortgage advisors, and we also give advice in New Zealand, we've got about 46% of people from our very last survey that go to a mortgage advisor, and they're trusted, very trusted. But 60% of first home buyers will go and see a mortgage advisor. So we're seeing the increase. And when we do our survey again this year, I'm sure we'll see that those numbers skyrocket.
I think it's really interesting to compare what's going on in across the three different geographies, and really appreciate your time. Lee Hodgetts and Stacey Penn, thanks so much indeed for joining me to talk about this topic.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, this is Susan Hayes-Cullerton here on Taking Stock on News Talk. And after the break, we look at the economics of tipping. Now, when it comes to tipping, it seems that no one in Ireland really knows the correct etiquette, whereas in America, no one is under any illusion. And if you're a waiter or waitress, you can expect at least 20%. So are we not tipping enough in Ireland, or are we tipping too much when we travel to the States? So I'm delighted to be joined now by well-known travel writer Fionn Davenport and by James Fahey, the co-founder of Just Tip. You're both very welcome to Taking Stock.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So Fionn, while we know tipping culture is well ingrained in the States, an employer of a tipped employee is only required to pay $2.13 per hour in direct wages if that amount combined with the tips receives at least equal the federal minimum wage. And that hasn't changed since 1991. That is really the reason why tips are so required and culturally embedded in the US. What's your experience of this system?
Oh, absolutely. And that's the case. So there are 50 states, only 7 states have gotten rid of that. Not to have the pre-minimum wage requirements. So only 7 states, and the only one that we Irish visitors would visit with regularity would be California. And as you said, so they can pay as little as $2.13 an hour. And I mean, part of it is it's meant to be is that there's this illusion somehow that like if particularly in the hospitality industry, if restaurateurs were to have to pay minimum wage to their workers, they'd go out of business. And that is baked into the economy of hospitality, as I said, across most of the states. And so the tipping then over the decades has gone from like basically, you know, thank you for the good service to like a social obligation, particularly because it's like when you go to eat in a restaurant, you're paying your waiter's wage, not the owner of the restaurant. And that, I think, is the biggest cultural difference between Europe and the United States.
James, can we move from culture to law? Because where does the Irish law stand on this, both from a staff member's perspective, as well as when we're automatically, let's say on a receipt, you might automatically see a service charge. Is that legal?
Yes. So the law changed in 2022 here. In the UK, it changed last year. So now it puts complete onus on the business owner, like complete responsibility that they deal with tips correctly. So that doesn't mean anymore of kind of going, you know, Susan's a great person, we'll give you an extra fiver this week. It's complete transparency for the staff, but also from the customer point of view, you have to know the tip is going to the staff. So yeah, the law is brought in, and like the most severe case in the UK is up to £5,000 per employee in liability if they're caught in breach. And the same law in both countries categorise a tip and a service charge as the same thing. So you can't just push everything through service charges now. Service charges have the same amount of weight on the business as tips.
And so the service charge has to be given to the staff?
Has to be given to staff. In the UK, 100% has to be guaranteed to the staff.
Fionn, the rationale for this from a customer's point of view is that it is an incentive for better service. Does it work in the US?
I mean, no, not really. I would argue not. I mean, which isn't to say that you don't get very good service in the United States. You do, but it all depends. And it's not simply because it's almost to the point where it's now become an obligation. So the idea of like the old 15% for many, many decades, 15% was the standard sum given for good service. Now, you could almost you'd be making like a real statement if you gave anything less than 15%. But that's crept up. Part of it is to do with like screens. It's to do with a post-COVID tipflation, they're calling it. So now 20% is now just the bare minimum. If you're not tipping 20%, and I've seen it happen over and over again, like for example, I'll go in or someone goes in visiting the US and they leave 15%, the waiter will come back and go, what is wrong with you? And so I don't know that it's an incentive for good service. I think it's so baked into the economics of restoration that like now it's just almost as though you just, when you're calculating how much it is, it doesn't matter. Like short of the waiter like dropping the food into your lap, you're just going to pay 20% no matter what.
Yeah, I've had that experience, all right. I remember having dinner in New York with a woman called Siobhan, and we left a 15% tip and the waiter came over and said, like, what's the problem? As if we basically hadn't...
Were you not happy?
Exactly. But also as if we hadn't paid for it. James, when I'm tipping... I'm interfacing with the person with the tip, I'm always concerned that maybe somebody has left early for the night, they're not going to get any. Maybe the tips aren't equally distributed among the staff, or maybe the employer simply doesn't give it to them, legal side aside, for whatever reason. Like, what problem does Just Tip solve? Do you solve any of my problems, in fact?
Well, I'd like to say, yeah, that's kind of the last couple of years of my life has gone into this. So what we do essentially is we guarantee that if you leave a tip for the staff or service charge through our kind of device or platform, it goes directly to the team. So whether it's a person-to-person, person-to-pool, or whatever way it's done. So like we started this back in 2021. We have nearly 16,000 employees in our platform now, kind of close to 700 businesses. And like we actually send out signs with our onboarding packs, which is kind of like we do transparent tipping here, like a window decal. I think it's a nice touch because we all work really hard for our money. And if you're going to go out of your way to leave a tip for somebody, you want it to go to that person.
So you're saying then as a result of using Just Tip, is that the money that I would leave to tip goes directly to the staff, doesn't even go through the business?
Exactly. So it goes from the customer through us directly to the staff. And come back to the piece around staff and retention, all that kind of stuff. At least with our platform as a customer, you know, you're going and maybe you don't even know Just Tip exists. Like that's also a good thing as a customer, the tip is still being left exactly as you knew it. But like what we find is staff drive this more. And they like it more. Like, there's nothing worse going into a restaurant and a customer saying, can I leave a tip? And a staff member goes, oh, don't bother. It's a
That's happened as well to me, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's worse for the business than kind of going, yeah, of course, leave a tip on this machine and it goes directly to us. I think what a lot of people don't see is all of the issues the business gets hit with to deal with tips. Like, let alone the staff issues, but also tax, regulatory, and all the other kind of inward pressures from everybody else going, are you stealing this or not?
Mm-hmm.
You know, 99.9% of employers are unbelievable people that will work overtime to make sure their staff get paid as much as they possibly can. It's kind of 1-2% that kind of can muddy the water. So I think what our platform does in essence is it guarantees if you leave a tip with us, it goes directly to the staff. And we also log it. We give access to the staff of how much came into the business. So, you know, Susan, $5,000 was collected this month in tips. You got 400 because you worked 40 hours and was paid to your Bank of Ireland on whatever day it was paid on. And we log and hold that for 3 years. So even if you're not with the business, you've got access to it as well.
And Fiona, if we just go outside of hospitality for a moment, because what everything there that James is saying, I'm running through scenarios in my head and generally I'm sitting down at a restaurant or in a cafe. But in the Washington Post, a survey quoted that 1 in 3 adults believe tipping expectations has gotten out of control. Now, you've taught me a new term today, which is tipflation. What's your take on not just the amount or the percentage of tips being taken, but more so the environments in which they're being asked for as well, like groceries or electronics, etc., about generally how tipping is moving and evolving in the US?
Absolutely. And I think that's definitely an issue. And as I said, since COVID, I've certainly noticed that all of a sudden, first of all, you have a percentage increase. So 15% is now almost nothing. It's almost an insult to the person providing the service. 20% in restoration. But even say, for example, you check. I mean, it's always the way you tip a taxi driver, you tip the bellhop when you arrive at a hotel, and literally for opening the door of the hotel, like it's expected that you might put a dollar or two in their pocket. And so it is across the board. Anything to do with the service industry, there's now an expectation that there will be a tip at the end of it. However, I'm going to play devil's advocate for a second for restoration. This is that whereas certainly for Europeans, it feels as though that restaurant owners are doing their staff a disservice. And they're basically, yes, they are offloading the responsibility for fair wages onto the customer. And that's absolutely the case. But it is also true that the way it's set up in the US is that many restaurant owners are terrified that if they have to pay a minimum wage, it means they're going to have to raise prices, which means scaring off customers. And to really kind of throw the cat amongst the pigeons, a lot of restaurant staff would oppose a minimum wage because particularly in high volume destinations like New York or the big cities of the United States, they can make an absolute fortune in tips. On a busy night, and I remember working in a bar in New York in the 90s, and this will tell you why. So the pint was $4, but nobody ever asked for change out of a five, ever. So you got a dollar. It was expected that you would get it for every pint you served. You put a pint in the bar, you got a dollar. So if you think about it, you might serve 400 pints over the course of a night. You know, $400 is like, and there's no way minimum wage can even come close to covering that kind. That kind of wage.
And indeed, playing devil's advocate there, although I does give another perspective on it. And I just want to evolve that conversation back to something, though, that James mentioned, and that's about tax. Because in the US recently, the Republicans in the House shared plans for a tax bill that would make tips tax-free. And that was, you know, first of all, there's great alliteration in that. And also, yeah. Trump was talking about that in his campaign as well. James, in Ireland, who pays tax on tips? Like, is it, if the money does go into the company, is that deemed as the company's sales? Like, could it incur VAT? And on the staff member side, do they pay all the usual income taxes? And what about the gig economy? Like, where does the tax burden lie?
So leaving aside what Just Tip does, so just your standard card machine from, say, Bank of Ireland, tip goes into the business. So €100 bill, €10 tip, 110 is acquired, it sits into the bank account. The business has to go and take that 10. They have to log it for the legislation, but they also put it through payroll, which recurs, you know, I know it's the highest band, but 11.05% PRSI for the staff, as well as the accountancy costs, as well as, you know, it's not actually €10 because then you have the card acquiring services on top of it. Then you have VAT and you have, I know you get it back, but realistically that €10 is actually about €8 because there's so many hidden fees that nobody from a consumer point of view will ever see. The businesses are the only ones that will ever see it. And you might not think it in a small coffee shop that in terms of affecting the business, but like we have customers that will process and accept excess of 1.5 million in tips. Mm-hmm. Then it starts to kind of hit the bottom line and you start thinking, well, there needs to be an alternative. So yeah, that's the kind of cost attached to the business. It's the PRSI one. Obviously, there's this disillusion in Ireland that tips aren't taxable. There's only a very few countries in the world.
There's an illusion around that, is there?
Yeah, most people think. So back
I'm guessing they think that if it's given in cash, maybe.
Yeah, well, cash tips are taxable.
Just let that one hang. Yeah
exactly. Yeah. And look, I'm not here to comment on policy for the government, but what the law says is it's additional income. It's the same as if you're a plumber and doing Ixer and you get a couple extra quid at the end of the week. It's the same sort of income. That should be all taxed. Now, I think coming back to Fionn's point around that percentage. So obviously post-COVID, the big change has been a lack of cash. Like there's customers of ours who would be previously walking across, you know, bridges in Dublin with 10 grand in cash in their bag to bring in to run afloat because people were wanting to leave a tip and they were cashing out the till, which again is not how you do tips. If you're taking a €100 bill and €10 tip and going to the till and taking out €10, that's tax avoidance. There's a serious issue mm-hmm. because that's attached to your business. So yeah, since COVID, what's happened is people want to tip. You know, that common question, you're on a table and you go, do you have a tenner? Do you have a fiver? Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think that's what's after happening. So when they're now pushing it onto the business as a responsibility, and what's happening is, well, it's now 10%, 5%, whatever it is. And then businesses are also turning that off. So to be honest, it's a complete mess.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly is. And as you say that, do you have a fiver, do you have a tenner? There certainly can be that conversation as well that can influence what side of generous the tip generally becomes. Fionn, an Irish Times survey said that 75% of people agreed Irish customers tend to tip when appropriate. But yet there was confusion around what is appropriate. So do you know?
What do I know what is appropriate? I mean, as a rule, like particularly, let's say a visitor goes to New York, so you're... It used to be that the local tax was 8.25%. So double the tax and that's your tip. So 16% was always a safe bet. And that was it. And that was the norm for 3 decades. Nowadays, as I said, since COVID, where 20% is now the baseline minimum, sometimes you see 25 or 30%. Now, what happens often with card machines, and we see it everywhere, is that they will give you the helpful, they'll calculate it for you. In that, like when you're putting in the card machine, do you want to add a tip? And they'll give you the options. And you'll see that the 15% has disappeared as an option. So it's 20, 25, 30%, or you can put in a custom tip. So there'll be 4 options. So you press whichever button you want. Now, to the point about Irish people is that I am convinced that Irish people are terrified of like being seen as anything other than grateful for the wonderful time they've had in the place. So they will tend to tip quite well, or they'll certainly tip reasonably and maybe grumble about it afterwards. Like, I can't believe it cost me an extra or whatever. But generally speaking, I've never seen anyone kind of quibble. Like, for example, and again, to cast aspersions on an entire nation. And my mother's Italian. Italians who tipping culture doesn't exist in Italy whatsoever because, you know, a lot of it is mom and pop restaurants, etc. Where it's just that. So I would speak to restaurant owners in New York and they would say that Italian visitors really struggle with the concept of adding 20% to the bill, but not the Irish.
There's a real Irish mammy context to that comment there now, but I'll...
there is.
Yeah, there is.
It's a bit like, oh my God, no. What if, I don't know, I don't want them to think that I'm really ungrateful. So here, take the extra, whatever, just... Get me out of this slightly awkward exchange. I say it kind of half tongue in cheek, but I do think it's very baked into the way we are. Like we're very, very careful about making sure that that when we leave a restaurant that we've like, you know, everyone should be feeling okay about it.
Yep.
We definitely don't like the idea of upsetting anybody.
We should have all left a good impression. Everyone. Yes, I see where you're coming from. James, from a business perspective, as we come to the end of this conversation, where's the growth in the market now for you for Just Tip?
Well, the States is obviously, you know, it's $84 billion tipped every year. That's just tips and doesn't include service. So where we're headed next is a little bit further away from that. I think there's going to become a lot of complexity around no tax on tips and all that kind of stuff. So from a business point of view, we're now growing into the EU and Australia. So we're basically trying to put ourselves in the middle of the employer and the employee and making sure the consumer knows if they see a Just Tip logo, it's going directly to the staff. So that's kind of where we're trying to get to. So over the next, you know, 24 months, you should see us in as many places as I can possibly put us.
Super. Well, best of luck to you with it. And thank you very much indeed to Fionn Davenport, a very well-known travel writer, and James Fahey, the co-founder of Just Tip. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it this week for Taking Stock with me, Susan Hayes-Cullerton. Hope you enjoyed the show and learned some new things about, well, what I consider the fascinating topic of economics and how it affects our world. Now, next week on the show, we'll be talking to a Boston College professor who thinks that we need to stay using cash. And of course, I'll just remind you, this show is available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you go to get your podcasts. And make sure to subscribe to us there also. And then it's on the radio every Sunday morning at 9 a.m. The producer of Taking Stock is John Fardy, and on research this week was Stephen Daunt. Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. Thanks so much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day, and I look forward to chatting to you next week.